Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report here on the BBC World Service. I'm Rahul Tandon. On this edition, shortly we'll take you to Japan to look at the elections there, and we're looking at those US elections once again.
Mr. Trump is a businessman. He's tough, but I think he knows how far to go.
More on Donald Trump and Kamala Harris and their impact on the US economy very shortly, but voters in Japan are heading to the polls. First, they'll be there on Sunday. The governing party, the LDP, has been in power for most of the time since the end of the Second World War. But as the BBC's Mariko Oi reports, the party is now facing a real challenge to win this weekend's vote.
As Japan heads to the polls on Sunday, just like in the US, the economy is a top election issue. In a country which had long battled falling prices known as deflation, voters are now having to cope with inflation. What makes it harder for Japanese consumers is wages haven't gone up in decades until very recently. That's why when it was revealed that some lawmakers from the ruling Liberal Democratic Party lined their own pockets, the Japanese public got very angry. Even in rural areas, which have long been considered the LDP's strongholds, some are now reportedly considering voting for the opposition. Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba was once the country's agriculture minister, so he is popular in rural areas, and he's pledged to offer some financial support. In fact, that's what the LDP did for decades to remain popular and to win votes. But economists say those measures didn't help revive the rural economy. And as one opposition MP said, if you're young and live in big cities like Tokyo or Osaka, you're automatically penalized. For example, the country's social security system puts a huge financial burden on today's working generation to support the country's aging population. But Japan is known for a notoriously low turnout rate, especially among the country's youth. So the result will also depend on whether they're going out to vote. It is fair to say, though, that this is one of the toughest elections the ruling party has faced since it briefly lost power from 2009 for 3 years.
OK, let's pick up on some of the points there that Mariko has raised. I've been putting some of them to Tobias Harris, founder and principal at Japan Foresight.
The impact of the yen has been weaker than it has been for some time, and that really is putting a squeeze on households as far as food and energy costs have gone up considerably. And of course, wage increases have not kept pace with that. And so, of course, that's been a priority for the government for several years. It's likely to remain a priority. It's not clear how much this election will affect the government's ability to make headway against some of these issues and really to get inflation up. Certainly, it will be difficult to expect significant new initiatives from the government if you have a smaller majority or if it has to rely on outside partners to pass legislation. But for the most part, the best the government's going to probably be able to do in the near term is just some relief and assistance for households that are suffering from the impact of higher inflation.
Japan, we talk about this a lot, don't we, has an aging population that leads to a number of challenges. A couple of questions on that. Does that aging population mean that wages will inevitably go up because there's less people in the workforce? And secondly, how does Japan pay for that older population?
The translation of labor shortages into higher wages has been, I mean, it's been a complicated process where I think there are parts of the economy where you are seeing labor shortages translate into higher wages. And I think particularly in the lower end of the labor market, the service sector, there's been some real shortages that I think have pushed wages up. But for a lot of workers, their wage setting, it's a more centralized process. You're not necessarily seeing the same impact of labor shortages in those areas. And so it's just a more challenging process. And I think the other difficulty really that Japan is having is there's, of course, lots of effort to encourage manufacturing in higher tech sectors, higher productivity sectors. And there, it's not even so much and the impact of wages, but you just have critical shortages of skilled laborers in some sectors. And so even though they really want to move economic activity into some of these higher growth areas, just not having enough workers to do that. And of course, you know, they're trying to bring in more foreign workers at all levels of skill, both highly skilled and less skilled labor to do some of this work. But it's you know, that is a complicated process. It's something that is not going to happen overnight. You know, the number of foreign laborers has been growing over time, but it's going to take time to really figure out the new look of the Japanese labor market.
Mm. Can I talk to you about the Prime Minister, Shigeru Ishiba?
Yes.
He talked, didn't he, when he was running for the leader of his party, quite a lot about rural Japan. So could we see more focus on rural Japan if he is the Prime Minister again?
This is something that's very important to him. He's from one of the more rural parts of the country. It's to the extent that he, you know, has a base within the LDP, and a lot of it is in rural Japan and his interest in that. He has talked, I think, in broad terms about trying to decentralize Japan, that, you know, arguing that the country's become over-centralized on Tokyo. It's not clear that he necessarily has a set of policy prescriptions that will reverse what really has been a long-term structural change in Japan. And really, you have young people leaving the countryside for the big cities. And so it's not something that was going to be unwound easily. And given that he is likely to come out of this election, I mean, if he survives this election at all, he's likely to be in a weaker position. It's unlikely that we'll see any real change on this front in the near term.
Tobias Harris there. Now, we like to bring you the voices of small business owners across the world. So let us take you to Tokyo now and speak to Kayoko Nagano, who is a sake expert in sake tasting events and brewery tours is a business that she has. Thanks so much for joining us here on the program. We talk about the yen, don't we, and the weakness of the yen. But on the other hand, for you, because you have lots of people, I'm sure, who are coming in from abroad to taste your products in Tokyo, is it good for you sometimes to have a weaker yen? Because it's good for tourists, isn't it?
Exactly. So actually, you know, tourism really accounts for 8% of the total GDP here in Japan. And thanks to the weak yen situation, which may not be good for Japanese economy, but for my business itself, it's actually flourishing because we have a lot of tourists coming into the sake tasting event. And also, for the export-wise, because of the weak yen, the export will grow because, you know, if they can benefit from having the weak yen situation and procure the sake that'll be exported to overseas.
You can give us a good perspective. So for your business, because you're based in that tourism sector, weak yen is good. But on a day-to-day basis for you, when you're going and buying products that are coming in from abroad, are you finding that they are increasing in price very quickly in the supermarkets and other shops?
That's true as well. For the people who are living in Japan are actually suffering the you know, the cost raise for all the essential goods. All the food materials have risen. So we do see that raise in the pricing, and that would affect economically.
We talk a lot about Japan's aging population and the challenge that that poses for businesses. When you're looking to get staff, is it difficult?
It is actually difficult, but I have managed to procure the staff from Taiwan. So in order to tackle the less of the human resources here who can speak multiple languages. So I do have a staff that is from overseas right now.
Stay with us for a minute because I want to bring in Chris Lowe, who is our markets guest from FHN Financial. We've been talking a lot there, haven't we, about the yen. It weakened again this week. Chris, do you expect it to continue to weaken? It'll be good news for our business owner who we're talking to at the moment. Is that going to happen?
Yeah, I think it probably is. And honestly, you know, one of the other driving forces there is the other side of the trade, particularly with the dollar, because the market has been pricing in less aggressive easing by the Federal Reserve, which would strengthen the dollar. And of course, the dollar is stronger not only against yen, but against most of the major currencies.
Do you know one thing that always strikes me, Chris, when we talk about Japan? When I was a little bit younger, a few years ago, a lot of those electronic products in the analog era, if we call it that, came from Japan. But as we've moved to the digital era, we haven't seen such success for Japanese technology companies, have we?
No, we haven't. And, you know, the primary reason is that labor repriced. It was very cheap at the beginning of the electronic age, and it got quite expensive in the 1980s and 1990s. But Japan is becoming more competitive, and it's becoming more competitive partly because the yen has weakened so much. It's making those products affordable again.
Kiyoko, if I can come back to you, and Chris was talking there about labor and the pricing of labor. You talked about bringing in workers from outside Japan. Whoever forms your next government, do you think they'll have to ease those immigration laws to help businesses like yours?
In a way, yes, because it took pretty much time to have the visa approved. So that the you know, when we aren't in need of the human resources from overseas countries, it's very essential to have the quick visa procedure. So I do hope that it'll be easing up much easier in the future.
And final thoughts: whatever happens in this election, are you confident about your business and the direction of the Japanese economy? It has struggled for some time, hasn't it?
Well, it has, but regardless of who would be the major part, you know, who would win this election, I feel that for my business itself, it wouldn't give too much of an impact because I think that weaker yen situation would not change drastically right now.
Well, listen, thank you for joining us here on World Business Report. We're going to be talking about the US elections in a few minutes. I'm going to hear from James Menendez. You've heard him across the BBC World Service. This week we'll get his thoughts on some of those economic issues. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World
Service. If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast, and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Service. Brazil's government has reached a multi-billion dollar settlement with two mining companies responsible for a dam collapse in 2015 that officials called the country's worst ever environmental disaster. The Brazilian president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, attending the signing of the agreement between the two firms, BHP and Vale.
Cada centavo que for utilizado.
Every penny used is considered an investment for us to recover the misfortune that the irresponsibility of a company caused. This is what must be clear. We are repairing a misfortune that could have been avoided but was not avoided due to irresponsibility and greed for profit.
Let's get more on this story from Ione Wells, who's in Sao Paulo.
At the moment, what's been agreed is that BHP and Vale have, according to the Brazilian government, agreed to pay what amounts to about $30 billion worth of extra compensation. Now, over the last couple of years, they have already paid billions of dollars so far in repair work. For example, they've started building a new city to try and replace one of the ones that was completely destroyed in this disaster. Interestingly, though, despite this settlement that's just been announced in Brazil, there is separate legal action that the companies are facing, both in the UK and also in the Netherlands. In the UK, hundreds of thousands of individuals who were affected are taking BHP to court. That trial began earlier this week, and in the Netherlands, further claimants are taking Vale to court as well.
Ione Wells there. Let us head to the United States now, the world's largest economy. We're in that final stage of campaigning for Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. They're both now in the Lone Star State, Texas. The warm-up act for Kamala Harris in Houston tonight is Beyonce. Donald Trump has already been speaking in the state capital, Austin.
But over the past 4 years, this state has become Kamala's staging ground to import her army of migrant gangs and illegal alien criminals into every state, paving a trail of bloodshed, suffering, and death all across our land. No person who is responsible for so much bloodshed on our own soil can ever be allowed to become president of the United States.
Also in the city is the BBC World Service's James Menendez. James, There are a flurry of polls that are coming out at the moment telling us exactly where we think we are in this race. What are they saying?
Hi, Rahul. Yes, I mean, they're saying what they've been saying amazingly for weeks and weeks and weeks, which is that this election is finally balanced. It's on a knife edge. Apologies, there's just a helicopter going overhead here. Yeah, they're finally balanced, and they haven't moved, amazingly, since really the summer when Kamala Harris was chosen as the candidate for the Democrats. She had a bit of a bounce then, but now they've settled down, and nationally, it's level pegging, but also, crucially, in those seven swing states, neither has an advantage that's beyond the margin of error. So I think even the most seasoned pollsters are saying, look, don't put any money on this election.
Okay, we're not going to ask you which way it's going to go, but you've been looking at immigration. We've heard those reports this week as well. But the economy still seems to be the number one issue. When you're talking to people about that, what are they saying to you?
Yeah, and it's been a constant refrain, not just on this trip when we've been in southern Texas, but also in a previous trip when I was in the Midwest and also on the West Coast. People are talking about prices, inflation. That's been the constant refrain. When are prices going to stop rising? Well, the answer is inflation has been settling down. But the economy, as ever, is the big issue in this U.S. presidential election, as in so many presidential elections before. And what is interesting is that the Democrats, message is that, you know, look, things are getting better. Unemployment is extraordinarily low. Those prices are starting to come down. But that message doesn't seem to be resonating with voters. The polling, again, if you believe it, seems to suggest that people trust Donald Trump on the economy more rather than Kamala Harris. Rahul, we've been looking at one issue to do with the economy, and it's essentially the shift towards protectionism in America. And it's not just limited to the Republicans and Donald Trump. He says he wants to impose a universal tariff on imports. Now, we've also spent some time in northern Mexico. And of course, if there are tariffs on Mexican imports, that would be a disaster. Mexico is now the biggest exporter to the U.S., bigger than any other country, including China. So when I was in northern Mexico, I went to go and see a business owner, Sergio Lopez. He owns a factory, makes precision tool parts for the car industry. That's the biggest employer in that part of Mexico. And it's one of those sort of web of supply chains across the border with things going back and forth across the border. I asked him about business with the U.S. and what he thinks about the prospect of that tariff.
Mr. Trump is a businessman. He's tough, but I think he knows how far to go. I understand that he wants to protect his country and his people, but imposing this tariff is like the U.S. shooting itself in the foot, because the only thing it'll bring is more problems.
It really has been, James, hasn't it? One of the central issues of this campaign, tariffs, protectionism of the U.S. economy. And you've been covering many different elections. Is the debate about the economy, do you think, slightly different this time? Because inflation is a factor and it hasn't really been a factor before.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. And, you know, the big question, obviously, about tariffs or taxes on imports, people say, well, if you impose those, then those costs are going to be passed on to the consumer. And that's going to mean that prices start to go up. So some economists are saying, well, Donald Trump's idea just, you know, it simply doesn't stack up. There are lots of other people, though, really worried about it, including people, I guess, who would be natural supporters, Republican supporters, inclined to vote for Donald Trump. You know, when we came back across the border, an astonishing place, the amount of trucks carrying goods back and forth across that southern border in Texas is astonishing. It does cut both ways. There are lots of Mexican companies, interestingly, finding opportunities in Texas. The state really is booming. I spoke to Victor Reyna. He's president of the Association of Mexican Entrepreneurs in the United States. He's based in the nearby city of San Antonio.
There's a lot of Mexican business owners either extending operations to the U.S. or already, you know, establishing or already established here in the U.S. So, yeah, we see a lot of manufacturing. We see a lot of logistic companies, a lot of service providers that are here relocating to the U.S. from Mexico.
So if there were to be, as Donald Trump has promised, a universal tariff on imports into the U.S., what would that mean, do you think, considering how much trade there is between northern Mexico and southern Texas? It would mean a huge cost for companies in this part of the world, right?
100%. I do see that. I do see it. It'll be, yes, increase in supply chain. I mean, it's just going to disrupt, you know, the commercial trade between the two countries, definitely.
And that cost will be passed on to the consumer inevitably, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Serena and Rahul, that is the bottom line, isn't it? People, nobody likes inflation. Nobody likes rising prices. But people also want cheap goods.
It is. It is a paradox that many economies are dealing with at the moment. James, as always, thanks for joining us. And you can follow James's reports across NewsHour as we head closer and closer to polling. Chris, whoever comes to power, and there are differing, I suppose, scales of protectionism that Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have. But when we're looking at China in particular, they're both going to put tariffs in place, aren't they?
You know, I think, in fact, the one signature piece of Donald Trump's first term policies that survived into the Biden administration was those China tariffs, which at first the administration talked about taking off. But ultimately, I think they decided primarily for national security reasons, they really do have to stay in place.
I'm always intrigued by the money in the U.S. elections, the money that's spent. It's huge. Some figures that have just come out. Kamala Harris pulled in about $187.5 million worth of donations during the first week of October, roughly twice as much as Donald Trump. I mean, there is just huge amounts of money flowing into this election, aren't they? Do you think it is money that will decide it in the end?
You know, there's been economic studies on this that show the money in the end has little impact. And part of it is because it's very hard to use effectively. If you live in one of the battleground states, for example, and watch television, you're bombarded with television advertisements, most of them loud and negative, every 10 minutes or so while watching anything. And the result is, by the end of it, by the end of the evening, you pretty much hate both candidates and wish they would all go away. Ultimately, what happens is we all sort of turn off the television for a few weeks and make a decision based on, well, according to Pew Research, based on reading as little as possible to make a call. Americans are withdrawing from the process.
It's true, but we are all looking, aren't we, for some sort of signal. James said it so eloquently when we spoke to him about which way this is going to go. And I suppose people are looking at the markets as well now and saying, if they move in one direction, does that tell us that one candidate may be slightly ahead? Are the markets jittery, do you think?
Well, it's interesting. I think that the trade this week, if you look at stocks, stocks had a good day today, but they're almost flat over the course of the week. And they had a terrible time on Monday and Wednesday. So sort of up a ton, down a ton every other day. But the bond market since mid-September has been on a relentless climb in interest rates, which to American consumers translates to an increase in mortgage rates of more than half a percentage point in just a month's time. And that is because the market is discounting the possibility that not only Donald Trump wins, but Republicans take both houses of Congress. And I'm not suggesting anyone thinks that's an absolute likelihood, but they do seem to be hedging against that possibility.
Well, let us find out. We will find out soon, won't we, Chris? And we'll be talking to you about that as well. We wanted to get to this story, our final one. Now, if your experience of going online is anything like mine, you spend as much time dodging pop-up ads on websites as you do actually reading the content. Well, would you believe it? It's now 30 years ago this weekend that the very first online banner ad went live on the tech magazine's Wired website, hotwired.net. Let's speak to somebody who was responsible for some of that, John Nardone, who led the way with that first ad as part of the team for modern media. Hello, John. It's 30 years ago. What an impact you've had on the world.
Well, it doesn't feel like it was that long ago. It feels like just yesterday when me and the other guys at Modem Media was the name of the ad agency, put those first ads together. You know, what's so amazing looking back on it is for all of the things that we foresaw at the time, and we really believed that we were on the cusp of the internet being something that could change the world, we couldn't have imagined in our wildest dreams the impact that it actually had. When, you know, we didn't imagine a Facebook toppling governments, or Zoom changing global labor markets, or iPhones changing the way we live and communicate. So, you know, advertising was just the really tip of the iceberg that created the commercial foundation for all those societal changes that came with the internet.
When you do something for the first time, there's often resistance to it. So when you came up with this idea there at Modern Media, were people saying, look, this isn't going to work? This sounds a bit silly, really.
Well, we actually had our clients were happy to go along. It wasn't a lot of money for them. It was AT&T and Coors Brewing Company. And that first ad cost $15,000 for 3 months. And they really viewed it more as a PR opportunity than a real advertising opportunity. But it very, very quickly spiraled, because in February of 1995, then there was a big article in Business Week, back when Business Week was an important magazine, and that drew a ton of attention to what we were doing, and things really took off from there.
Yeah, it's been successful. It's also annoying, isn't it, at times?
Well, you know, it was funny because at one point, you know, telling my kids about it, they didn't believe me. They were like, "Dad, no way, you can't have done that." And they Googled it and found that it was true. And then it became, okay, Dad, so you're responsible for ruining the internet.
Well, there you go. At least you made an impression with your children. Many people struggle to do that. How do you think it's done, you know, now? And I suppose the way that the internet has developed, what next?
Well, the first thing is, you know, for as annoying as advertising is, you know, it is the commercial foundation of the free internet. The internet could never have become what it is if you had to pay to get online or pay to use every website that you went to. So the fact that advertising created an environment where consumers could access this tool for free is really an important driver of what's happened. But, you know, when you think about the impact that the internet's had, it's much more than advertising, right? It's societal. It's touched every aspect of our lives.
It's changed everything, hasn't it? Really. Listen, yeah. We're coming to the end of the program. I have to say, it's been really lovely to talk to you. I wish we had a bit more time and we could talk about it a little bit more. But thank you so much for joining us. John Nardone, who led the way with that first ad as part of the team for Modern Media. We'll be back with Business Matters in a couple of hours' time, focusing on those Japanese elections.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast, and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.